Our next case is appeal number 21-2216, Reuter v. Commerce. Mr. Magri, whenever...
Yes.
Did I say it correctly?
Yes, you did.
Good.
Thank you.
Whenever you're ready, please proceed.
I think this is a very important due process case, which was not fully appreciated by the district court or the administrative judge in his rulings. If one looks at the communications that preceded the ultimate proposal and the ultimate decision, one sees threats, veiled threats in March communications to both Streltrek and Bernhardt, as well as an individual by the name of Paul Doriamus, who's their boss. He, in turn, sent with copies to them to very high...
We are very familiar with the facts of this case.
What?
One of the things that I was thinking about is our... case law, our precedent does have some things that we are to consider in determining whether a communication is in fact an ex-party communication,
yes.
Right? One of them is whether it introduces cumulative or new information. Another one is whether it's likely to result in undue pressure. You mentioned the March 9th, 2017 email from Dr. Bolden, I believe is what you were referring to.
Yes.
Why is that not cumulative information?
Mine is at 1324, and I thought I'd reverse.
You will absolutely have your rebuttal. What will happen is the light will turn yellow when you go into your rebuttal time, and I'll try to remind you of that.
Thank you very much. Your question was?
My question was, why isn't the March 9, 2017 email from Dr. Bolden to Mr. Streltrek merely cumulative to other information? For example, I think that she said something like, why are you not taking any action yet? And she doesn't say what particular action, but why hasn't this been resolved? I mean, I think that probably it was known since she was the proposing official that she in fact did think that something should be done in this case.
So well, she wasn't the proposing
official.
She wasn't the proposing official.
She initiated the...
She did.
She
did that, but none of that was something that Mr. Reuter knew as to what was going on and what was going on at various stages. So in none of the communications that occurred in 2017 or even earlier were things that Mr. Reuter knew. There's no way that Mr. Reuter could have said you shouldn't be acting on the basis of these communications.
But what is the new and material evidence that was introduced into the deciding official's universe
threats.
Of cognition here
yes.
that by that email? What is it that
the,
more
that
on,
email,
his, on his guilt or innocence that was contributed by that email?
Well, I think Stone and Douglas want one to focus on whether or not undue pressure was put. And so that email puts undue pressure on the officials. And when one looks at the May 2nd communication...
I mean, that's one factor. You're pointing out one of the factors, but what about addressing Judge Bryson's question in particular?
Which one?
The question that he just asked about what was the new and material information that was introduced.
Well, I thought it answered that. All of the information here are things that Mr. Reuter had no idea about.
Right, but that doesn't necessarily make it that information, new and material information, going to his culpability.
But a threat has got to be new.
That's a different issue. And so you're saying that there was undue pressure. Okay, but that's not the new and material evidence prong of ex parte communications, right?
Well, I think that if the decision is going to be made on the basis of threats, It is. And in this case, you can see that that's exactly what happened. When you look at Dory Ramos's communication to the agency officials above, the last group that he wanted to send that to was OSC. At that point, there was a pending proposal to terminate. After that point, the email comes where Mr. Bernhardt is talking about communication from Bolden, and he's afraid. He's afraid. He believes that she will not only file claims against them, but she will impair the OSC investigation. And she conveys that to the, he conveys that to the deciding official. Shortly thereafter, they withdraw the proposal, the first proposal, and then they institute a new proposal. That new, so clearly those emails had an effect on the entire process at that point. If that, they, the new proposal supposedly only considers stuff from before he made his October 8th whistleblower disclosure. Well,
so isn't... I think you like the undue pressure one, so let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
So on that particular prong, so to speak, does the reporting structure have any effect, in your opinion, on whether or not something would constitute undue pressure? Right, because there's kind of a reporting structure here with the various people involved. Do you think like higher up on the ladder would be more pressure? I'm just trying to get a sense of your take.
Well, I think it's more pressure when you actually have the boss sending it up the chain, sending it to OSC, and then you see the causation in terms of the withdrawal of the first proposal. And in that letter, the suggestion that it, she may impair the OSC investigation is remedied by the withdrawal of that.
Just to make sure I understand, are you saying that the email sent by Dr. Bolden was sent to OSC?
If you look at the...
I'm looking at page A1635, which is the actual email.
Take a look at 1635, the top email. John, I would like
where
you...
They, it's forwarded.
It's where it's forward.
Okay.
John, I would like you, the agency, and the OSC to be aware of the message below. Now, they are in the one below, this is not the one where in on May 2nd, Bernhardt is saying, I am now afraid. It is her apparent belief or attempt to portray that I'm the villain in this piece.
Where are you reading from?
I'm reading from
what page?
Appendix 1674. And he says, I'm the villain in this piece, and that there's some risk further complaints from Steph will come. I'm concerned about the potential impact on pending OSC investigation. So here we have an admission of the undue pressure. And then we have causation when they withdraw the current one to take OSC out of the process. If that doesn't affect Mr. Reuter's rights at this point, it's hard to imagine what else could. He could have had OSC looking into his claim and seeing whether or not it was appropriately done. And instead, they to avoid that, they...
To make sure I understand, yeah. This is not connected to her March email, correct? I just want to make sure I understand that.
Yes, I believe it is.
A1674 is not expressly, or you're inferring that it is, but there isn't anything here that connects it.
Well, it doesn't say in follow-up to that email.
No.
It doesn't say that.
It says attached is her perf plan with progress review, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But it in the context of this case, it's hard to view any of these things as are unrelated. If you start right from the beginning, you can see a tie-in where he makes a complaint, an OSC complaint, And for the first time that there is actually a draft proposal, which is on November 3, that comes after there's a conversation between her and Bernhardt where she's saying, I would like to propose his termination. And but I'm afraid I won't have support of management. And Bernhardt says, please do what you think is proper. I'll support you. I'm at yellow, but everywhere, if you just track the communication throughout, you see reaction to the things that she's doing. And none of this is things that Reuter knows about or could address. And it's all affecting his rights. And that's the whole concept of Sullivan and Stone, the effect on the process.
Some of our precedent talks about, I think it might have been Stone or Sullivan, talked about how the ex parte communication was recommending particular penalty. Do you agree that none of these communications indicate a particular penalty?
Oh, no, I don't agree to that. Because okay. She was the one that recommended on November 3 of 2015 his termination for something that...
But that was part of the record that he knew about, right?
No. That was in a timeline that he didn't know about. That timeline also referred to a PIP that was under investigation, which he didn't know about. And
he didn't know that the recommendation had been removal?
Not on that day. He didn't know about the removal thing until November of 2016, but he did not know about her recommendation for removal on November 3rd.
Suppose that all of the documents that you contend should not have been kept from him had been disclosed to him in the course of the removal proceedings. What would he have been able to do that would have helped his cause?
Well, one of the things he would have been able to do is litigate the propriety of the claim that she has made. Her claim was, I am a victim of sexual harassment. To think that in this case there was sexual harassment when that was not found by Workforce Management Office, it involves a momentary action that, of course, deserved punishment in the form of that Workforce Management Office said. But this became sexual harassment. Sexual harassment, I do those cases. This is not one of them. And
conduct unbecoming a federal employee.
Of course. But no one told you that is the charge.
Right.
But that charge has been transferred into sexual harassment throughout this case. It shouldn't have been.
Right, but to go back to my question, which I don't know that I got a complete answer to.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. I may not have made it clear. What I'm really struggling here to see is, suppose he had been copied on every single one of these emails. I mean, a preposterous hypothesis, I suppose. But suppose that he'd gotten every one of these at the time they were sent. What would he have been able to do that would have changed the outcome of this case?
On one hand, he could have attempted to litigate what she was saying. But on the other hand, there may be nothing.
What she was saying is, let's get on with the show. Let's move this along.
No, that's not what she was saying.
That was certainly what she was saying in 1635.
Well, she wanted it to get up to the, but she wanted the action to be taken, which at that point was removal.
Right. Okay. Well, suppose she said, you know, I'm very upset about this. I think he should be removed. And she's copied him with the email.
Could,
how would that be a violation of his due process rights?
Could he have litigated the concerns or addressed the concerns of upper management or other management within the agency about how they would look if other claims were filed or if issues were created based on what she was saying, how could he address that? Why is that a consideration in an employee's case? Why can't an employee's case be decided on the basis of the facts?
Can I ask you,
yes.
I want to ask you that. Like I went back and looked at the specifications at issue here, and none of them involve the treatment of Dr. Bolden. Thank you. Dr. Bolden. Instead, they involve the treatment of other females at an after-hours party, right? I mean, that was the claim and specification that was at issue here. So I'm a little confused about your answer that this was decided on the basis, I mean, the whole opinion and everything written is decided on the basis of specifications 1 and 2, right?
Well, the opinion is, but without proper consideration of the due process claims. But
why would there have to be litigation with respect to Dr. Bolden's email?
Because her emails are saying you must remove him, not because of the facts, but because I'm upset, they're upset, we will take action against the agency. Doesn't that trouble you? The fact that someone would be trying to influence a decision maker by threatening the agency?
I might not read her email in the same way that you do.
Well, it made Mr. Bernhardt afraid.
I thank you for your argument. You are in your rebuttal time. Would you like
I want to reserve whatever I can have for rebuttal.
Okay. Do you have
rebuttal?
Any further questions?
No.
Do you? Okay. Mr. Long?
Thank you.
May it please the court, the board's careful analysis of the ex parte issue is supported by substantial evidence and it should be sustained. Going to, I think, what was some confusion in your prior conversation with my friend Mr. Magri, there were two charges. There was conduct unbecoming and inappropriate behavior toward a supervisor. And so that first charge relating to the party and the day after, those were supported by two specifications, which I think Your Honor, the presiding judge, was referring to. And then there was some conduct that involved Dr. Bolden that took place in the workplace. I don't read Dr. Bolden's message at Appendix 1635 as addressing the workplace, what ultimately became the workplace charge, but rather seems to be focused on Mr. Reuter's behavior at the party and the day after toward two former agency contractors. And so it does not detract from the board's analysis. My point is just to sort of clarify the record in that respect.
Can you address this whole issue about whether or not these ex parte communications were cumulative?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that the board's analysis at Appendix 51 and 52 don't focus with respect to Dr. Bolden's email on the cumulative nature of that, of the information therein. I think it's fair to wonder how Mr. Reuter would be surprised that Dr. Bolden was concerned about his behavior. The board's focus instead was that this communication was less extensive than the case primarily relied upon by Mr. Reuter, which is Sullivan, which is a very different set of facts. There were repeated communications. There was a four-page memorandum from a Captain Westbrook to the deciding official. And that really formed the basis of the board's analysis. I think going to the newness and materiality of the information, and then the board proceeded with respect to this email to consider the possibility of Dr. Bolden placing undue pressure. And the board concluded that that was not likely due to the nature of Dr. Bolden's situation. She had requested around that time a demotion to a non-supervisory position and some other things. And I think going to Judge Cunningham's question of my friend, the fact that it was a subordinate, I think, is a pertinent point. There are some cases in which there were communications from the deciding official's superior.
I mean, that she was a subordinate.
Yes, Your Honor, yes. I apologize.
Reuter was a subordinate of hers.
I was speaking of, yes, Dr. Bolden being subordinate of Mr. Bernhardt and ultimately Mr. Strelchak. There is some relevance to that. It's, Stone tells us that it's a case-by-case, fact-bound analysis, but the board clearly was focused on that as well, in addition to the workplace, I guess, situation or dynamics that were in place at the point of that March 9, 2017 email. I apologize, Your Honor. But one other factual point that I wanted to touch upon is I am not aware of any evidence in the record that the OSC investigation was impacted by the withdrawal of the notice of proposed removal by Mr. Bernhardt. That notice of proposed removal occurred on August 31, 2017. I am not aware of any evidence that there's a connection there, and it was suggested, I wanted to make clear, I don't believe that's the case.
How do you respond to Mr. Magri's point that the timeline provided something new because it gave information, for example, including the early date at which Dr. Bolden was suggesting removal?
The board addressed this and its findings supported by substantial evidence and finding that it wasn't, it was cumulative information, I believe, and in that, I actually am not picturing the board's statement on this, but it was cumulative insofar as Mr. Ruder was aware that Dr. Bolden had learned of these allegations and brought them to the attention of management. And so it's difficult also to understand why it would be particularly material that she had proposed it. I don't understand how that really would have an impact. Well, why it would be important to know from his perspective in terms of his ability to respond to that, that she had been interested in his removal at that point as opposed to some later point or Mr. Bernhardt, who ultimately was responsible actually communicating the recommendation or the proposal to the deciding official.
Do you think that the fact that there was a withdrawal of the initial notice and reinstitution of the notice has any effect on any communications that may have occurred prior to the institution of the second notice? Put another way, do you think that the fact that the process was begun again with a new notice effectively renders the prior any prior communications less significant?
I don't think that was a focus of the board, Your Honor. I think they were more focused on the duration or the
I'm just curious.
Right.
That's part of the position here or not? It's not. I mean, Mr. Magri is saying it has no effect whatsoever.
Right. We're not taking. The government is not taking the position that the rescission and reissuance could negate any improper earlier ex parte communications. It's fact bound. I don't want to go too far out there on it, but in this case, there's no reason to take that position, I think. If there are no further questions,
let me ask you this question, and I think I'll ask it of Mr. Magri again as well. What is it your understanding of the universe of communications that we should be looking at here? We have obviously 1635. And we have had our attention called to one or two others. 1674, I believe, is one of them. What are the, so that we have an idea of what we're talking about here, is it a closed set that we can look at?
Well, Your Honor, like the court,
I should ask Mr. Magri first, but do you have an idea as to what we're talking about? Because there are references to communications and a focus on 1635, but I was unclear how many of those communications we have here in the appendix and which ones are deemed objectionable by Mr. Roeder.
Well, Your Honor, I think and hope that the appendix contains the universe of communications that were brought up at the board. That said, I think, obviously, as you would expect me to say, Mr.
Go ahead.
Oh. Mr. Reuter is obviously master of his own case. The briefs focus on particularly that March 9, 2017 email, and there are sort of passing references. I think the reply brief talks about another email that hasn't come up yet. Oh, I'm sorry, that you discussed with Mr. Magri, that that back and forth, or single email, I guess, about Dr. Bolden's performance review. Those are really the two communications that I view as being placed.
What about the timeline?
Here. Yes, I suppose the timeline does come up in the opening brief to some extent.
Is that at JA-1671? Is that the timeline?
That is... I apologize, Your Honor.
Yes, that's 1671.
Yes, Your Honor. That is, as Judge Bryson has beat me there, it is at PPX 1671. Yes. And so I think it's fair to conclude, and of course Mr. Magri will have his own view, that those three communications are really what's been placed at issue as the universe of improper ex parte communications that would support this due process violations. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Magri, restore your rebuttal time to 3 minutes. I'm sorry? Yes, he can have some rebuttal time.
Thank you very much.
Give him 3 minutes.
Before we start his time, could I get his answer to that question?
Absolutely. But before he starts his rebuttal time, Judge Bryson's going to ask him this question.
I just wanted to ask you the same question that I asked your opposing counsel.
Yes.
What is the universe of communications that you see as objectionable? Because it was not clear to me entirely, at least from the briefs, as to which ones are ones that you think created the due process issue here.
Well, I have pointed out the 1868. I've pointed out, or I'm going to point out, 1635.
1635, I have. Okay.
And...
you say 1868.
This is the one where Bernhardt's saying he's very afraid and further complaints and potential impact on OSC. And okay. I'll also point to a 1679 as well. I want to say one thing, though, because I think it's important. From our standpoint, my belief is that from the beginning, Ms. Bolden was making a singular claim, in essence, that he should be terminated. She met weekly with Strelchek, she testified on Appendix 2080. To talk about the status of the investigation.
Can you just pause on that? I just want to make sure I've got the universe
right.
Yeah.
Okay. So just make sure we've got, it's A 1635, A 1679, and A 1868. Those are the pages you're referring us to?
That's it. Full stop, right? Thanks for it.
Well, those are the written communications, but these reflect... Each of these documents reflect prior communications with her about this issue. She testified that she met weekly with Strelchek about these issues.
We're just
I have page
sure
2080.
Okay. That's
but see, oral...
1868. Is that what you're referring to?
No. You said her testimony...
2080. Appendix 2080. It wasn't limited to just written communications. It included the oral ones that occurred, and there were many in this case.
I understand, but on appeal, you have to identify what they are so we can look at them.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And so that's why we're asking you these questions. Presumably, they're in your opening brief.
Well, now, 2080, did you say? Because I don't have a 2080. I have... I jumped from 1949 to 2086.
Which means it's not in your opening brief.
I guess not.
It's not in the appendix. Unless you have the page wrong. Is that possible?
It's not possible. I was looking at...
Check your appendix. Do you have any copy of your appendix there? Because it's possible that my appendix is missing a page. That happens sometimes.
shortage.
So I skip in my copy of the appendix from 1949 to 2086. Yeah. All three of us have that.
There is, it is 20, oh wait a minute, but 2086 is the one.
2086.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you.
It's, I had to report to Streltrek Weekly.
You can go.
And the.
Can I ask you one other thing? You mentioned the timeline earlier, and that is page A1671. Are you dropping that argument now since you didn't identify it?
No, in the timeline, it identifies not only that she proposed the thing, which,
I don't want your argument right now, because I haven't even spent your time.
I'm not dropping it.
We're just trying to
identify
communication. So my question was, because you didn't mention A1671, I want to make sure you're not waiving it right now.
Oh, no, no.
No,
I'm not waiving it. The sites that are in the brief.
Okay.
I'm not.
Okay. All right, thank you. I think we understand the pages you've identified, so we're going to go ahead and start your time now.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I understand those three factors in Stone to be weighable. You know, you look at each one of them. And if one of them is particularly strong, you have to consider that with the others. It is hard for me to overstate, and perhaps I'm dead wrong. You're the protectors of the process, and you're the people that have to make these decisions. But it's hard for me to understand how it is that someone that is putting that kind of pressure to cause a second-line manager at Commerce to say, I'm afraid. And I think this will hurt us with the OSC. And I think more complaints will come. It's hard for me to understand. And none of those things, by the way, are Reuter. His guilt or lack thereof. So it's hard for me to understand how that is not undue pressure in a very significant way. And it occurred periodically. When he made the whistleblowing case on a claim on October 8th that the judge found. Well, on October 13th, there is, and that's KK, that's Appendix 01679. There's a meeting with Bernhardt in Bolden where she is saying, I don't know if you guys have my back. If I want to terminate him. I don't know if you have my back. And he says, well, you ought to do what you think is right. And she keeps protesting. And he ultimately says, if you propose it, I'll support it.
Now, what page is that again? You gave me a page.
01679. 01679. Now, after that, that's on the 13th. Then comes the proposal on November 3rd. Then comes the stay while another investigations are being done. And then a whistleblowing complaint is filed in June of 2016. And Bernhardt knows he's listed as a subject with OSC, and he's interviewed by OSC in August of 2016. All of these things are one follows the other. In the process of this, the same request or demand, I submit, is being made by Bolden. Terminate him.
Can I do you have any further? You're out of time. Do you have any further sentence to wrap things up?
I think I'll rely on what was said. I appreciate your kindness with time and whatnot. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted on the briefs.